Welcome, everybody. I'm Ray LaHood, Secretary of Transportation, and it goes without saying, you've already heard it, but we are so delighted that all of you took time out of your busy schedules to be here. And we want to really begin with just a couple of opening remarks, and then Peter will make a few remarks, and we'll be off to the races with whatever any of you have to say about any of the issues that you're dealing with and how you think you can be helpful to us in whatever suggestions or ideas that that you want to come forward with. I have been in this job since January 23rd. I've been to about 32 states and more than 70 cities, really making sure that the money that was provided by Congress for the economic recovery, primarily infrastructure money, is being spent correctly and that people are working. And I'm very proud to report that all over America, where there are orange cones and orange barrels, there are lots of people working. The money that we received, 75% of it is out the door. We think thousands of jobs have been created, and we think the opportunity for people to go to work that were on unemployment in January, February, March has been extraordinary. We see it in roads and bridges, at airports, in transit districts all over America. And we really followed the guidance that Congress gave us to get the money out the door, to get people employed. We think our portion of it is working. It'll continue next year. It's an 18-month program. So as winter comes on, many of these projects will continue next year. Some will be started. So I think our report from DOT is a good report in terms of job creation, in terms of opportunities, and so I will turn it to Peter and let him make whatever remarks he wants, and then we'll be listening to all of you.
Yeah, and again, I think the main thing that we want to do is hear from all of you. I guess I would remind you that there are members of the press in the room, so if you had anything that you didn't intend for them to hear, I wouldn't say it.
Thank you, Peter.
Hello, friends. And I'd just like to join Ray in welcoming you. As you know, we have been working very hard on getting the Recovery Act money out the door quickly and well. At the same time, we have a series of policy issues coming down the pike, from highway reauthorization to perhaps additional funding beyond a reauthorization bill to next-gen on our air traffic control system to, anyway, you can go down the list, and that's what we'd like to hear from you about. And I thought maybe to start things off, if we could hear from Paula about your experience with the Recovery Act and how it's going and what, if any, obstacles you're encountering and other thoughts you might have for us. And I suppose also, if we could just have everyone provide a your name and what you do might be helpful to the others in the room to have the context.
Do you want to go around the room and do that first?
Sure, why don't we do that for everyone? You want to start here?
It's a good idea, thank you.
I'm Angela Glover-Blackwell, founder and CEO of PolicyLink, a national organization trying to create more inclusion and equity, and one of the things that we have at PolicyLink is the PolicyLink Center for Infrastructure Equity, really focused on places, projects, and people that will make a difference.
Paula Hammond, I'm the Secretary of Transportation for Washington State.
I'm Gerard Arpey, Chairman and CEO of American Airlines.
I'm Reed Hunt, I'm here for the Coalition for the Green Bank.
Peter Darby, I'm CEO of PG&E Corporation that owns Pacific Gas and Electric Company.
I'm Dan D'Amico, Chairman and CEO of Nucor Corporation, one of the nation's largest steel producers.
I'm Chandra Brown, President of United Streetcar and also of Oregon Ironworks.
And I'm Mark Harris, President of North American Building Trades.
Frank County, Mayor of the City of Des Moines, capital of the great state of Iowa.
I'm Rick Moorman, I'm Chairman and CEO of Norfolk Southern Corporation, one of the four major U.S. railroads.
I'm Steve Heminger, I'm Executive Director of the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, which is the Metropolitan Planning Organization for the San Francisco Bay Area.
Great, why don't we go back a bit? Yeah.
I'm Ron Perry. I'm a farmer from Missouri and a small business owner, and I also run the Missouri Rural Crisis Center.
My name is Teresa Daintner, and I run a commercial construction company that I founded in 2003 here in the DC metro area.
Shorty Whittington. I'm from Indiana. I'm a trucking company. We haul hazardous materials. And I'm just the past chairman of the American Trucking Association.
I'm Doug Holzaken. I'm a self-employed economist, retired political hack.
Larry Cohen, President of the Communications Workers of America. I'm Ed Whitkin, President of the AFL-CIO's Transportation Credit Support.
Robert Fuentes, the Senior Fellow of the Perkins Institution, Trent Collins, Policy Director.
Okay, great. Paula, why don't you kick it off with some thoughts on the Recovery Act?
Well, thank you first, Secretary. Nice to see you again. I represent 50 CEOs of the heads of departments of transportation around the country. As the Secretary of Transportation in Washington State, it has been our focus and our intent when the Recovery Act was passed, first of all, to be the shining star in the delivery of the programs and projects. We have, across the nation, been delivering those projects, met all of the goals and timelines, 100% of the funds, the state funds were obligated on the July 1st deadline, and we are delivering millions of hours of jobs. Nationally, I just want to tout a little bit about what's done and then give you a suggestion. But we have amassed nationally, as of the end of September, 29 million hours of work on our highway projects alone, worth $850 million in payroll dollars for workers across the state, across the nation. In Washington State, we've exceeded all of our DBE goals. Our contractors have really stepped up, even though we had a short timeline to get these projects on the ground. We've done a good job of bringing in not only the apprenticeship programs, but the DBE programs, and getting the jobs out to the disadvantaged, economically distressed communities and counties in our state. Washington State got $492 million worth of highway projects alone, and 85% of those projects are now in construction or completed. So transportation agencies, transit agencies around the country are getting the dollars spent, putting people to work, and now, of course, looking for the next infusion of transportation dollars. Our association of ASHTO, the State Highway Association, just recently released a report. We did another roundup of projects. Do we have them ready to go? Can we meet the commitments of 120 days to obligation? And we just published our findings that we have 9,500 projects, highway construction and local road kinds of projects ready to go. Our transit agencies in our communities are also ready to continue to invest in that infrastructure that we so badly need. We've tallied up the dollars on what we could deliver in the 120-day obligation timeline, and it's about $70 billion. So the years and decades of neglect on our transportation system in the country are really starting to show that the good news is we're ready to deliver. One of the suggestions that we have is to consider, with the Tiger grant still pending and the, was it $65 billion or some huge number of applications the administration received, and only $1.5 billion available for Tiger grants, if there's an early infusion of funding, perhaps more money could be spent on funding the Tiger grants that the administration currently has in hand. We're looking very much forward to the selection of the high-speed rail programs around the country, so that those spendings can get underway and we can continue to improve on our high-speed rail systems across the country and in our corridor, which is Amtrak Cascades. The other issue for us is the reauthorization. We feel like we can't wait a few years for the reauthorization to kick in, if you will. And if there's any way, even for a longer-term extension with an infusion of money, not called a stimulus, since that seems to have a bad moniker, but to work hard on the jobs created by infrastructure spending that we might see come, we know we can put the money to work to get our ports ready for the imports and exports in the global economy that we see coming, get our highways ready and accessible for the regrowth in the economy, and to get our transit systems working well inside our urban areas so that we have more livable communities.
Do other people have one of the central tensions, and I might bring in Doug Holzaken or others, is it has often been the case that there are very attractive shovel-ready suggestions that we have X billion, so nearly $70 billion ready to go. And then when we try to move the money for whatever reason, whether it's to get environmental clearance or this or that, the money does not go out the door as quickly as one would have hoped. And I don't know if Doug or others want to come in general. Doug, if you want
to. I think it's a very important point to promote a project that I recently completed. I spent 2 years on a project by the Bipartisan Policy Center, the National Transportation Policy Project. It calls for a thoroughgoing reform to our transportation efforts so that we orient them around better economic growth and abilities to compete internationally. Fabulous product. I encourage you to read it. But one of the lessons is that we need to so deeply change the way we do our funding to meet urban accessibility requirements, national connectedness requirements, that it would be a mistake to try to do that in the context of any short-term stimulus. It would be at odds with good programming structure. And even within the existing programming structures, Peter's right. The evidence from all the years at CBO and others is that the money in the end simply does not go out the door as fast as you might think when you look at particular projects. This is not a vehicle, I think, that's ideal for this kind of very near-term, short-term stimulus.
If I could just, it's true when the 120-day requirement came onto the project spending, we were torn in our states between rapid program delivery on projects that we knew we could deliver without a lot of permits. So we went after a lot of preservation kinds of asphalt, concrete, bridge preservation kinds of projects because they don't require a lot of permits. That we fortunately in our state were able to bring forward projects that we didn't have enough cash to complete, which were substantial highway widenings, capacity improvement types projects that will definitely be a boon to the economy in the future for transit and freight movement, which is an important part. But had we not had those projects started, we wouldn't have been able to match up our stimulus funding with them to bring them and advance them into this year.
I think if we could bring in Ed and then
come on. Thanks. I guess I would just offer the following observation. You've got obviously two significant infrastructure bills that are sitting in a sort of state of suspension, the highway transit reauthorization and the FAA reauthorization. Both of them embedded in determining those bills are sort of mini economic recovery bills. So if you move that money out quickly, you can put people to work. I would just submit the following, that based on the data I'm seeing out of the administration, the Secretary's agency, DOT, has done as well or better than any agency in job creation. I saw a figure recently where 4% of the money went to transportation and a fourth of the jobs was created in transportation. Second of all, I guess the second point I'd make is, if we're talking about how to find ways to create economic productivity and create jobs at the same time, this FAA bill, with the unfunded needs of the aviation system, with the next generation system sitting there waiting to happen, with Randy Babbitt and ready tomorrow to implement with the right resources, I think you've got a great opportunity to create jobs consistent with the president's vision and trying to get ahead of them. Thanks.
Peter, I just wanted to return to your question about delivery, because I think it is a problem. I was fortunate to sit on one of the two congressional commissions that were created to advise on authorization. And we had a lot of testimony around the country on this subject. The average delivery time for a federally aided highway project is 13 years. Minneapolis just replaced a bridge in 13 months. Now, we can't do everything on an emergency crisis basis, but we've got to get a lot closer to 13 months than 13 years. And that has a lot to do with repetitive reviews, doing everything in sequence, not doing it together. Federal permitting, which often comes from multiple federal agencies that sometimes give project sponsors conflicting advice. Permit processing time, which certainly could be faster. And I'd be an advocate for even using some of the funding in whatever the authorization or appropriations vehicle to pay for more staff at the permit agencies that are dedicated to infrastructure projects to get them approved. We are burning up a tremendous amount of taxpayer money, not stopping bad projects, but making good projects take longer and cost more. And I think to restore some public confidence in the program as well, I think we've got to show people that we can make their money go farther faster before we ask for more of it.
Peter, I have an idea there.
Sure.
We've had this problem in California, I found, with bringing renewable projects to market. And in fact, we did some case studies where we looked at it and it took, in some instances, 9 years or more. And so we've given a lot of thought to this issue. The recommendation we made to the governor in California, and we think it's appropriate on the federal side, is to appoint someone who has accountability for coordinating the efforts across state agencies, state and local agencies. And what we'd like to do is have a counterpart at the federal level, and they would work on a collaborative basis. So the first thing is to create individuals with accountability for actually getting through the gauntlet of federal or state agencies.
You mean at the project level, or do you mean on the government side?
It would be on the government side, creating accountability among federal agencies and state agencies to say, you have an accountability to get these things done, the approvals, in a timely fashion. And in addition to creating people with the accountability for that, then set targets of expectations, and then also going to the point that Steve raised, look at best practices and constantly push people to best practices. The issue that we have at the state and local level, as well as at the federal level, is none of these agencies feel an accountability for getting things done in a timely fashion. So a renewable project, which should be good for the environment, takes 9, 10, 11 years to bring to market. That's not right.
Maybe we can explore this in a little bit more detail in a second.
Peter, Mr. Secretary, I just wanted to underscore an earlier comment. We've talked about high speed a lot today. We don't have a high-speed aviation system in our country, and that's largely because our air traffic control system is antiquated. It was built in the 40s and 50s. It relies on ground-based systems, voice communications, radar sweeps to keep track of airplanes, and that all can be modernized through the global satellite positioning system, and there are plans in place to do that. The obstacle, of course, is funding, but this is infrastructure, and it's infrastructure spending that could lead to jobs, lead to a more modern aviation system without all the delays that occur today. We'd also, all the circuitous routings, we'd also burn a lot less gas, which would be good for the environment. So I think it's an ideal project for what the president talked about earlier today. And the FAA, the airlines, the general aviation community have worked together on multiple proposals to accelerate next gen and make it now gen, which could benefit everybody in this room. So that may come across as a parochial pitch, which it is, but aviation benefits everybody today, and we're not doing it as well as we could. It takes longer today to fly from New York to Boston than it did in the 1940s.
Right. Maybe we can get a little discussion on next gen specifically, because obviously there are two pieces. There's the physical infrastructure that the FAA, that's the federal government's responsibility, and then there's equipping the private aircraft. My understanding is, correct me if I'm wrong, that a lot of the policy discussion has surrounded the degree to which the federal government should subsidize the purchase of equipment for private aircraft, and that might be worth having perspectives on. I think that there are a clear set of proposals on getting the federal government's infrastructure in place to be able to send the signals and what have you, but getting the equipment on the planes.
Right. And of course, to do that takes a lot of money, and there's no secret what the airline industry has been through this past decade. With virtually every legacy airline going bankrupt with the exception of American Airlines. So the airlines simply aren't in a position to invest in the infrastructure necessary to modernize the system. And that involves both the airplanes and what the FAA needs to do. But I think it's an ideal project for government because it is infrastructure in the sky. You can't see it, but it is necessary to have a robust economy.
Not on the issues that I was hoping to get a chance to talk about yet,
we'll come back
one here.
Yeah.
All right. At some point in time, the government is got to get out of paying for all these things, all right? Now, I'm a regular flyer on the airlines. My family's a regular flyer, okay? Have been for years. No one wants to see fares go up. But at the end of the day, we need to improve our air traffic control system. I agree with you 110%. And somewhere along the way, the people who use the airlines are going to have to foot that bill.
You're
not
already
every...
paying about over 20% of every dollar you pay today goes to taxes, fees, and whatnot. That has quadrupled.
But my point here is that every airline needs to do it. The government does its thing where it has the sole responsibility to do it. Getting the equipment installed has got to be the responsibility of the airlines, and they're going to have to figure out a way to charge their customers for the use of the airlines. At the end of the day, all your customers, me included, will be better off for having a better air traffic control system in place, safer, and the private segment has got to pay for that, not the government. And it's got to be passed along. It just has to.
Maybe Frank and then Mort. And I should say, this is part of a, hopefully we'll, in different areas too, a sort of user fee question and who should pay for different pieces of infrastructure, clearly dominant throughout a lot of this. But why don't we go Frank and then Mort.
I just might make a pitch, Secretary LaHood, for local government. And we work closely with IDOT in the state of Iowa and working on transportation projects. I would suggest to you that we might think about ways that we fund local projects. Metropolitan areas in most states, 90% of the GDP comes out of those metropolitan areas. And while we fund lots of transportation sometimes, and certainly there's connectivity is a big issue, city to city, town to town. We've got 948 of them in the state of Iowa for anybody that's keeping track. But in the meantime, the system that we used, we talked about the STP funding formulas originally was 62.5% went to local government and 37.5% went by law to states. Now, under ARRA, it was 70-30, the opposite way around. States got 70 and local. But we had this complicated system laid out that has been in place a long time, which is the MPO system. And so the states get the money, and they've got to direct certain money to go to MPOs. And MPOs, we have to go through. We can't do all the EIS studies or anything else till it gets okayed. All the people in our areas have to submit all their projects. I think for 16 projects, there was over 100 submittals out of our MPO. It made it really hard to get the money to a local project and then to follow it up after we got approved. Then we had to do all the studies. I would suggest that, and I don't know if you want all of us to make comments, but I would suggest that sort of a targeted fiscal assistance to some of these areas would speed it up and not have to go through this whole painful process that takes way too long. The states have sort of an advantage over us to be able to go ahead and approve some of these projects. We have to not only meet state law and federal law and local process that complicates it. So I would suggest that to get money to where people live, to where people work, to where the GDP, at least for the portion that you decide needs to go to those areas, we find a system that targets that local fiscal assistance for transportation projects and other infrastructure projects.
Mort?
Yeah, I'd like to sort of deal with this issue in a longer perspective. Whether it's bridges. unirail system from Las Vegas to Disneyland is not going to inspire people to support this kind of program. And yet we need a lot more than what we're doing. And so you've got to take it out of the political system, put it in some kind of professionally managed decision-making process where the decisions are made much more on the basis of the national interest and the economic value to the country than the particular system we have now. It's not going to be an easy thing to do. I think it's absolutely critical to the long-term health of this economy.
I know there are lots of people who want to get in, but maybe if we could just stay with the infrastructure bank for a second and then turn to other topics. So if folks have particular views on an infrastructure bank, as you know, the administration has supported a version of an infrastructure bank. But to stay on that topic for a second.
Yeah, I was going to mention that.
There you go.
We were supporting it even before we fell into the recession and we to have the recovery because we felt that infrastructure has been so neglected for so long that it absolutely needed this kind of professionalism and focus where we could also bring in some of the equity concerns, making sure that if you have an infrastructure bank, some of it is focused on communities that very much need investment, and we begin to develop a fund that could do some of the job training programs that are also needed, that could also come out of the infrastructure bank being matched in other ways. So I want to very much support the infrastructure bank and mention two other things which you might want to come back to. And one is this notion of targeting that, and I think the infrastructure bank would help on the targeting issue because again, you have a more deliberate focus rather than the way that it happens now, which is rather haphazard. But the targeting is absolutely essential because there are areas of the country that need it more than other places, and we ought to have a way of being able to direct it. From the opening comments that Paula made, it's clear that if we target places where we already have a built environment, not only can we get that going more quickly, but we actually get more out of it in the long run. The fixing and repairing produces more jobs and produces better results. And the last thing I hope that we will come back to again and again in this conversation is how we make sure that people who are being left behind by the economy get jobs through infrastructure investment. That just because there are jobs created doesn't mean that those jobs get distributed to people who need them. And we haven't set aside enough money nor brought in community colleges and other training agencies with enough specificity to make sure that that job piece also gets in there.
So, Robert, and we'll come back to Paul.
So I'm Reed Hunt. I'd like to speak in support of Mort and Angela about a specific kind of infrastructure bank, namely Green Bank. Mm-hmm. And I'm here speaking for more than 100 businesses that have formed a voluntary coalition to ask Congress to charter a Green Bank. In fact, the House of Representatives did do this in the a bill called ACES. They spelled Green Bank CEDA. The Clean Energy Deployment Administration, and it's passed the Senate Energy Committee as well. So our group would respectfully suggest that the administration and Congress get out a pair of scissors and cut the provisions for CEDA out of the energy bills and literally paste it into a jobs bill so that we can get started right away with this particular aspect of a national infrastructure bank, which is not in any way at all to gainsay the importance of extending it to other areas as soon as possible. And in addition, we'd like to suggest that the administration consider the following important but very modest change in the existing legislation, and that is to tell this Green Bank to act on an emergency basis over the next 3 years on a state-by-state basis to prioritize the creation of jobs where we find the deepest and most severe pockets of unemployment. We wouldn't normally do that in energy. Normally we would approach it with other priorities, and Peter knows this better than anyone here, but we would suggest to you that the joblessness crisis deserves at least the addition of that as a priority to the goals of a Green Bank.
Let's bring in Bob Cutner.
You know, this part of the conversation connects to the earlier part where the problem of the short-term versus the long-term and the need for more shovel-ready projects is one part of the problem. On the other hand, we also need to rationalize the process of infrastructure spending. I would submit that there's an idea that's been around in various forms since the unemployment of the 1970s, which really fits this situation. Namely, you need a permanent standby, ready-to-go program of pre-approved projects, so that when unemployment hits a particular level in a particular state or locality, government can greenlight a certain release of funds for projects that have been pre-approved, so that the next time we have this crisis, we don't have to start worrying about the short-term, long-term dilemma all over again, because we will have the standby program in place. Then the only question is, at what level do you fund it at? So this is an opportunity to put something in place for the long term. And unfortunately, this is going to be a long-term crisis of relatively high jobless. I think two other quick points. One, because of the catastrophe of state's local revenues, something like two-thirds of the federal dollars that have been expended in the Recovery Act are being undercut, at least in macroeconomic terms, by shortfalls in state budgets and tax increases, which is the most perverse thing you can do in a recession. So I think one ready-to-go project, if you will, is emergency intergovernmental aid, where you're not dreaming up new projects, you're simply preventing cutting of existing projects and laying off of existing workers. I think there are things like port modernization that could and should be federalized. Some of that's short term, some of that's long term. And one plug for a special project that really isn't infrastructure, but is also ready to go. The fact that community colleges are laying off people and turning away kids in a recession is not only unconscionable, but it's crazy macroeconomically. And we were talking at the breakfast meeting with Secretary Donovan, again, not a housing issue, but the topic that came up and several of them supported. You need stipends for kids as well as scholarship aid so that they stay in school and complete associate's degrees and certificates. That's ready to go. You could have that up and running in 3 months. And you wouldn't be creating jobs now, but you'd be steering kids into better jobs in 3 years, and you would be taking people off the unemployment lines or out of the labor force, putting them into community colleges, where the only thing standing between them and persisting is the cost of earning a living. So for about $15,000 per job, if you will, you could be keeping kids in school. So there are a lot of things that are ready to go, in a sense, that could be done in the short run while we rehabilitate a longer-term strategy for infrastructure spending.
I think Doug, and then come back to Robert.
I just want to say a couple things. Number one, again, I think the proper focus of this is over the medium to long term, because the historical track record of using these kinds of projects very stimulus is simply not to our expectations. And over the longer term, I at least want to be a voice of dissent on the national infrastructure bank. I don't see any particular problem in getting access to credit markets. We have the finest access to the United States Treasury. The problem is not some sort of credit problem. It is about targeting the funds effectively. So we need to reform the way we distribute these monies so that they're distributed on the basis of performance metrics like order congestion, other things that can be observed, will be held accountable for improving, and get our money's worth. And in terms of financing these over long term, I think the rule that to the greatest extent possible, you use user fees so that those benefiting from these infrastructure projects are supporting them, you get more efficiency, you get more long term economic job growth out of that, and you get projects that are self financing. So I think that's the package that ought to be on the table in all these areas. And that means that
Chandra, and maybe the folks who are in favor of an infrastructure bank, if they could make it clear whether there's a sort of financing, there's some financing magic or benefit, or it is, there's no magic there, but you have a different set of people making project selection decisions, and that's what you're really getting at with an infrastructure bank. It might be useful not to conflate the two.
Right. You could
yes.
Refinancing, for example, including the finance state and local projects. We have to give them that kind of option. It seems to me to really make it effective.
Well, let's circle back to this in a second, Shauna.
Well, and I want to broaden it out a bit, and first also do a little bit of gratitude that this is revolutionizing things, that you have finally been working together with transportation, HUD, and EPA to actually bring that all together is really incredible. And I think that's what really needs the focus on. And I agree, if you look at something, and obviously my experience is with a streetcar, but exactly when you talk about funding in Portland for a $75 million investment by the federal government, you are going to leverage those dollars over 20 times. Along a 4-mile line, you had $3.5 billion of investment within three blocks of a streetcar line. I mean, you have to have the private folks. You have to. We took 70 million vehicle miles traveled annually off of Portland. That's why we are actually decreasing our carbon emissions as a city. It's incredible. Transportation is a win-win-win if done properly. And what I'd like to see is more leveraging of federal dollars. You must be a partner. We absolutely have to have it be a piece. But that doesn't mean absolutely we as private industry and other folks won't all be sharing part of that burden. We have business owners that are asking to pay. They want to be on the line. They're saying, we volunteer to pay more money. Create an LID. You know, it's 99% return on that. So you can actually do something that has private investment as a partner with the federal government. And I think that's the model, which also accounts for the climate change and everything else. So we're incredibly huge supporter of, you know, the 280. Thank you very much for 2 days ago, that great announcement for streetcars and buses, and for a 6-year plan that we will contribute. And we are hiring. We are hiring. We've got hundreds of jobs that a streetcar will create, not just that we build the vehicles, but the thousands of construction jobs that will continue for the 30-year life cycle of these transit projects. It's a great story. And I don't think that's getting out as much as it should, and it's just a wonderful thing. Thank you.
I think Robert, and then why don't we go down the row over here? We'll come back.
I had to figure out a way to jump in here.
Yeah.
I keep changing my comments.
just let them all rep right now.
We're kind of landing on three big buttons, and kind of building off what the remarks from downstairs earlier. I think the first order of business has to be to stop the hemorrhaging of jobs. You have to stop losing jobs right now. So I agree with the mayor and Robert that the municipal aid, it's really a critical thing that we need to do right now. 11% of jobs within metropolitan areas, it would absolutely be something we should do in the real short term. Related to that, transit operating assistance is also very critical. We had money for capital projects for transit agencies with ARA. At the same time, these agencies were laying off literally hundreds of workers, so there's an incongruity there that can be fixed. Again, all of this stuff is stopping the hemorrhaging of jobs. But then we do need to put people back to work, and I think ARA is also illustrative here. You know, we know that the CDBG program, which is kind of much maligned over the years, has actually turned out to be quite effective in putting people back to work. And a really good bang for the buck with these projects. And the good thing about MARA, with the focus on transparency and accountability, to kind of address some of the problems, I think, that plagued CDBG in the past. So that's one thing. I think fixing existing infrastructure, restricting the transportation money to fix the existing infrastructure, gets to some of the targeting that we talked about. These are projects in existing places that we know need to be fixed. We see mundane reminders of that all the time. We see trash reminders of that all the time. Just directing that money to fixing what's broken, I think, is something we can all get behind. And then the Build America Bonds has really proven to be quite successful. I think the private sector likes it, the states and locals like it, and I think the federal government likes it. It seems to be something that is used. So Build America Bonds is also a good thing. And then to tie into these comments down here, that we also need to think about building the next American economy. How do we leverage all this other potential that's out there? These may not be short-term, you know, ready-to-go kind of things, but national infrastructure banks certainly can help fund those kinds of projects that you're not really getting right now. Because of the way that the federal government works, and because the states are in charge of so much of the money, we don't get those projects that really do meet these criteria for national significance. So, for me, that's what I think that the National Infrastructure Bank does the best, and gets you those really significant projects that we just don't have a mechanism for now. And then the TIGER grants, I think, is the other great idea. We know that this has really unleashed a lot of innovation that has been laboring under the surface. $1.5 billion in money has leveraged was $55 billion in applications. but not all
it was
praise.
56.5.
Was that what it was?
I didn't come up there.
But it's a close enough. So we can fund that pipeline of projects. Again, they're kind of ready to go, and they do get for this multidisciplinary, multi-jurisdictional we've been talking about.
Okay, thank you. We're going down the back row here.
Okay. Larry Cavallin, communication workers. Three quick comments. First, I mean, well, we've run into a lot. So our union's 700,000 people, five industries. But what we run into a lot is that federal policy and even state and local cut across often the jobs issue. So one sort of general suggestion we make is that on policy decisions, we stick with what President Obama said this morning, and we actually put a jobs footnote on all policy decisions, or at least when requested. So we've run into this constantly. Could be FCC, as Reed knows. We don't talk about jobs. It happens all over the federal government. So if we're serious about jobs, and I'm not saying it should be a block to a merger or anything else, but we at least ought to deserve a footnote. What are the consequences of decisions on jobs? Wide range of decisions. And that's something, you know, that we want to pursue here and beyond. Otherwise, we're doing little things and we're missing big things. Let me just bore in real quickly on a couple of things that affect our members. So first of all, I want to second the FAA NextGen. We have 50,000 flight attendants and customer service folks and airlines, and they definitely, it's ridiculous. They fly around the world and look where we are. And to follow up on that, 300,000 of our members are involved in the internet, building and maintaining internet networks. We are off the charts now in terms of where we rank in high-speed internet in this country. And it's great to talk about broadband. The rest of the world's talking about high-speed at 100 megs. Australia has a program to bring fiber optic to every house in Australia. It's a rural country. It only has 25 million people. It's as big as this country, depending on where we count Alaska. So we need, when we talk about infrastructure, and we're all for the, for roads and the rest of this as well, where it makes sense, and the infrastructure bank, does makes great sense. But if we don't start setting goals, like, 100 meg internet, or at least 10 meg, and we continue to talk about broadband, which, we did a lot of work to get broadband defined as 1 meg last year, got raised to 1 meg. It was at a quarter of a meg. It's got to be upstream and downstream. And to go back to a point, the third point is, we've got to bring in rural and urban America into this. So we work with a group called Alliance for Digital Equality. We need digital mentors in communities across the country. Because it's not just about building a network and then, only certain people use it. We need to build networks and create demand and bring everybody into the new economy. And that means the digital economy. That's going on now in Brazil. It's been going on for 5 years. If it's going on in Brazil, we ought to be able to figure it out here. So digital mattering, let's label the speed. We have a campaign called Speed Matters. We don't even measure speed in the internet in this country. We've been doing it on a giving it away, speed meters. So measure speed, bring us into the 21st century, create a real digital mentoring program that can create lots of jobs. They can be inexpensive jobs, they're very quick. And let's put jobs notes on all the policy decisions we make across the government.
Okay, I think we still have some folks who haven't come in at all, so.
Well, I keep changing my remarks
okay.
as well. I'll start by saying in the National Infrastructure Bank, of course, railroads are privately owned. We invest our own capital and maintain our networks and build capacity. I sit here as one who has not studied it and hear the comment about access to the capital markets and the requirement that there be private investment and rational decision making, and I would question why you need a national infrastructure bank per se. To the uninformed, it sounds like, I'm not getting the decisions I want from a political perspective, and therefore I want to put another mechanism in that will change that decision making process. I want to go back to the immediate issue, which came up right away, and I want to compliment Secretary LaHood for what they are doing in the Tiger Grant process, because to the awareness I have of it, it's being done very thoughtfully, very rationally. They're looking at issues, which are issues we have Tiger Grant applications in about can you get it done. I agree with you on you need to straighten out some of these processes. You know, we build capacity and infrastructure on our property, and the issue is never getting it built. The issue is always if you need a little property or you have to get a permit, you allocate three or four times the time it requires to actually do construction. How you do that and build a sense of urgency, I don't really know, but that's what it requires. But going back to this Tiger Grant process, if you want to create jobs right away.
Hey guys, it's reserved.
How are you?
Good to see you again. Good to
How are
see
you again?
Good. Have a seat.
It's my nice Peter Darby.
Great to see you. Sorry to interrupt, but we didn't want an empty chair.
How are you?
Where were we?
We were in the middle of the discussion. I think there have been three things, that three broad buckets of topics that have come up. One is lots of enthusiasm about additional projects that could be ready to go. Some questions about permitting and other things that slow things down, and whether there are a few ideas that have been put on the table about trying to speed things up or have a always-present stock of ready-to-go projects that have already been pre-approved, so that in the future, if we wanted to do this, it would flow more quickly. A lot of discussion around infrastructure bank and what it would or wouldn't do. And then finally, discussions about particular types of investments, NextGen for the FAA, broadband, and actually an interesting question on NextGen, for example, whether the federal government should pick up the cost for equipping private aircraft, or whether that should be the responsibility of the airlines and passengers. We're in the midst of one of the comments.
Okay, well, finish up the comment. Who was speaking?
I'm with Norfolk Southern Railroad Company, and I was just finishing up a comment that in terms of the immediate issue, which is the creation of jobs, one of the lessons that I take, I think a number of us take, in looking at stimulus programs around the world and what the Chinese have done, where they allocated an enormous amount of money to infrastructure creation. As a result, we're seeing an enormous amount of steel being produced in China. We're seeing a lot of effects even on our company in terms of shipping goods overseas. And with a process that's in place, like the Tiger Grant process, where you have a lot of demand and a very little, relatively small amount of money allocated, it seems to me that it makes perfect sense that that's a great way to get even more infrastructure work going, and that's making an investment, because we have an infrastructure crisis looming in this country, and what better way to fix it than plow money out there to fix it, to work on these worthwhile projects.
Okay. Paula was next on the list.
Paula, go ahead.
Mr. President, I'm Paula Hammond. I'm the Secretary of Transportation from Washington State, and representing the 50-state delivery of the Highway Recovery Act dollars. One of the things we talked about in the infrastructure bank, we're so concerned about our basic ability to repair and keep going the asset that we have, that we're worried that investment in an infrastructure bank might take away from that. The last six-year Transportation Act had $286 billion in it. We're asking for looking at both transit and highway investments of $545 billion. In other words, the money that's there just isn't enough for repairing and maintaining and using our transportation infrastructure as wisely as we need to in the future, both from an operational standpoint and from a capacity and freight movement respect. So one of the things we're interested in, if there's an infrastructure bank, love to see it, but it has to be capitalized, and we can't forget about the rural states and the states that need to maintain and prepare and preserve their existing infrastructures. Our cities and counties are also dying on the vine from the aspect of having potholes and existing streets crumbling under their vehicles.
Right.
Peter, could I say something?
Of course.
I don't need friends.
Well, we appreciate that. Why don't you pull up a chair?
Go ahead.
back in the work. I did it on the work, and it did work. The infrastructure at work. The problem is, and Peter brought it up earlier, is getting the money to move. And there are some ways to do it. There's leadership from here to get the environmental agencies to cooperate in the permitting process, right away after the permitting, to go to my attorney with the design. $1.5 billion Katie Freeway project in Houston, done in record time because everybody gave it priority. And the answer to me is representing my company, and I think most highway contractors, is infrastructure spending does work. Question is how we get the money out.
Good.
Angela Blackwell, Powell. So many Americans are being left behind because they live in places that are being left behind, and those places are leaving them behind because of inadequate infrastructure. So I just want to emphasize again, we need to target the infrastructure investments, whether it's sewage or transportation or the higher form of broadband. I'm with you on that one.
Okay, great.
But I don't think that we can do this without coming up with a mechanism to get people trained who really need these jobs. We have a 1,000 community colleges serving 12 million students, 44% of undergraduates. We really need to have a joint partnership with community colleges in this country so that they can begin to train people for the infrastructure investments. Because if we don't do that, we'll do infrastructure as usual and we'll still end up with all of these people being left behind. So target places and target people and target the kind of projects that allow people to enter the 21st century.
To that point, and to Mr. President, PG&E created the Power Pathway Program, which we talked a little bit about this morning, that was focused on the community colleges. And we asked ourselves, what kind of skills are required to do work, come out of the community colleges, and perform entry-level work at a utility or other levels? But not just for utilities, we actually extended the program into adjacent areas. And then what we did was we worked with the community colleges to create the curriculum for these people. And in addition to that, then we would go in and mentor students in the program and say, this is the kind of background you need. These are the kind of job opportunities. But we went even further and we reached into the high schools and said, in order to be eligible for the Power Pathway program, this is the kind of course group that you need. So we work with the kids in the high school, many of them underprivileged, and bring them up so they could get into the community colleges, and then from the community colleges prepare them so they could take jobs in our industry. What I'm working with the sponsor of that, a woman named Von Tone, who's an immigrant into this country, is how we can actually expand this and train our entire electric utility industry and have the schools based in California or other places to connect education in high school, community college, with businesses. So it's a great model. We've provided testimony to Congress about the idea.
If we could bring in Douglas Holzeke in.
I just want to emphasize that I think you use infrastructure for the appropriate goals. I mean, that is sustaining economic growth, long-term recovery, but sustaining economic growth, and to do it better than we've done in the past. We have to fundamentally have transportation and other infrastructure be distributed on the basis of performance metrics so that our money's working. It is no secret that the budget deficit is a real problem going forward, so money's going to be tight. So to the extent possible, have these projects funded by user fees so that those benefiting from the infrastructure are funding its upkeep, which is a very big problem, and also the initial outlays. So I think we need to really avoid rushing into things, step back, rethink these programs. We have 100 transportation programs that the Secretary has to manage. We could probably define a clear federal goal and have only four, and use money much more effectively in that way. That
I think would be best for school. Mark, why don't we all make sure we're introducing ourselves to the president? Yes.
What is it?
Good to see you guys.
Good to see you. First of all, I want to thank you for selecting the right secretary at the right time, and the fact that he's from Peoria.
He's from Peoria. We knew he'd play there.
That's right. I just wanted to say that you're talking about training and career opportunities. There's nothing that will create more jobs like a massive investment in infrastructure.
We have the training infrastructure in place at the building trades. We invest $900 million a year in private money for training. So we're prepared to do the training. We're prepared to reach out and help those typically left behind with community workforce agreements. All we need is more projects started. You've done a fantastic job already, but we need a little more. We stand with you. We're ready to get rolling.
Let me just interject real quickly, because I want to pick up on a point that Doug made, because it raises the tension that we're struggling with right now. Everybody in this administration acknowledges the need for infrastructure investment. There's nothing I would rather do in terms of our long-term sustained economic growth than to be able to get us back on the track where not only are we making an investment that is immediately creating jobs and profits for businesses, but that is also laying the foundation for economic expansion. The tension that we've been seeing is that what is good long-term may not necessarily work as a immediate short-term stimulus. I mean, we're still getting slapped around in the Recovery Act for this. You'll remember, because Douglas is familiar with these various political debates, that what happens is that, you know, infrastructure generally has a longer tail. The term shovel ready, let's be honest here, is not always doesn't always live up to its billing. And there's also been a tension embodied within infrastructure that was already raised between the immediate maintenance, repaving a highway, which is generally more shovel ready, but may simply duplicate the needs of the past as opposed to projects that are visionary and are really going to give a big bang for the buck long term, but require some extensive planning, and you know, you want to measure twice before you cut. And so part of the reason that we were looking at an infrastructure bank was to accomplish two things. One, three things. One was to be able to do what Douglas just talked about, and that is to really start having tougher criteria for what we're investing, given we can't invest in everything. Number two, to give a platform whereby we can think long term and not just short term through the usual politics of the transportation appropriations process. And number three, that we are able to leverage potentially private sector dollars that are right now sitting on the sidelines to see if there are models where you can get, you know, the big institutional investors to say, hey, we'll put some money into this so that we can leverage what are going to be limited dollars. So that's been the idea. But the question I guess I have is twofold. One, to resolve some of these tensions, what can we do to make shovel-ready more shovel-ready if we are putting more money into infrastructure? Because without the American people seeing this translating into job growth right now, it's hard to get them to be interested in what's happening 2 years down the road. That's point number one. Point number two is, are there thoughts, and maybe those of you in the private sector can think about this, are there ways that you think we can leverage private dollars into this process? Last point I'll make is that I just came back from Shanghai, and you're right, somebody made the point, infrastructure is pretty remarkable when you look at what's going on in China. I think it was you, Wick, but you know, the Chinese don't have this thing called democracy that you have to deal with. So shoveling out a whole lot of money, tearing down whatever is there, conscripting folks to do the work is not as tough. But anyway, Anybody want to address those two questions?
There were some ideas that are already on both permitting and having coordination, so maybe if we could briefly summarize those.
So we have, in California, what we've discovered is something called the gauntlet of collectivity. And that is that each state, local, and federal agency by its own is being very logical, they're being very rational. But when you look at the collectivity of all of that, it creates an incredible gauntlet so that even a renewable project to bring to market can take 10 or more years. Renewable, not a fossil generation. Okay. And so our recommendation in that respect is, and I made this to the governor and he's adopted it at the state level, is to identify a person at the state level who has the authority to hold agencies accountable, not only for doing their job, but creating a timeline to bring projects to market so that they have an accountability, because they don't feel it right now. And we do the same thing at the federal level. So first we create people with the accountability and the empowerment to bring things to market in speed from government. The second is to set targets and to say, okay, this is what it should take, and anything beyond that's a fail. Are you failing or will you fail? The third thing is there have been a number of really remarkable examples here about how people have gone from 10 years to 10 months. And I think these people should look to best practices in America and try and push these best practices in and say, this is the standard we hold you to. But right now, no one is really holding government effectively accountable at the different levels to make things happen quickly. And you yourselves have seen it because the stimulus dollars are not getting out there. So you can identify and agree with the problem that the private industry is facing. With respect to the how to leverage the dollars in areas for in electric utilities and the like, for smart grid or electric transmission and things right. like that, well, my recommendation is do a matching dollar proposal. So, and it doesn't have to be 50-50, it can be whatever the ratio you like is, but say, if you get this moving, if you do it in this time frame, we will match, you know, $1 against your one, two, or three, depending on what you think makes sense.
Okay. Steve, your answers.
Yeah, Mr. President, Steve Hemminger from San Francisco. Maybe two thoughts on two of your questions. The first on acceleration, I gave the example earlier that the bridge, remember, that collapsed in Minneapolis, it was replaced in 13 months. The average duration for a federally aided highway project is 13 years. So we know how to do it faster. A lot of it has to do with sequencing so that you're doing things parallel instead of in sequence. I suggested earlier we ought to take some money, it would be a good investment from our infrastructure programs, and spend it on staff at the permitting agencies, at Fish and Wildlife, at the Army Corps, at EPA, to get permits processed faster. Mm-hmm. So that's idea one. Idea two on leverage, you also have the chance to leverage government, local government and state government money. My CFO always tells me to spend other people's money first. And one way you could do that is an example. Secretary LaHood has a mechanism at FTA called the Full Funding Grant Agreement, which is a contract you enter into with local government to build a transit project, primarily rail extensions. Most of those projects are over 50% non-federal, and most of that money is already committed. But until those FFGAs, they're called, are executed, that money's not going to flow. And there's a queue of them at DOT. And normal course of business, you do a few of them a year. My recommendation, you ought to accelerate the bejesus out of that and get more of those agreements executed. And that will trigger that local money, folks going out and borrowing funds, putting the committed funding to work, so that your money is leveraged at least 50% by local investment.
Good. I'm going to have to go to the next group, but Wick, you had a closing comment, or anybody else? Frank, go ahead.
Mr. President, I just want to tell you I appreciate you asking us all here to discuss these issues. I represent local government. 2009 to 2010, we're going to see an additional $40 billion shortfall in local government. So we're going to have not a great ability to do a lot of these infrastructure projects. So only with partnerships with the federal government are we going to be able to make it happen. In the city of Des Moines, we're trying to strategically target certain infrastructure projects that will spur private investment. You talked about one a few minutes ago with trolleys and those sorts of things. where people actually begin buying one, two, three blocks on either side of the trolley line and making billions of dollars worth of investment. We want to leverage private sector funds on the investments that we make to make sure that we get the private sector involved. Two or three things that I've heard from my business leaders in the city of Des Moines, they say that, and some of them may not have been voting for you earlier, but now that they're thinking about it, they're wanting to know, Mr. President, they need to, it's the not knowing that seems to bother them more than anything else. Corporate tax, income tax, capital gains, they're afraid to make investments without knowing where that's going. Whether I put a road in or a rail line in or light rail or anything else, they want to know what's happening. Cities are 90% of the GDP in many areas of this country, and in Iowa, we're serious. Secondly, we've got to figure out how to get small business money. The banks have locked them down in Iowa, and those that do not have significant financial reserves are having a heck of a time doing it. So we can put in the infrastructure, but we've got to figure out how to look at the financial industry and see that, I mean, they're instead of 5% with this real estate deal or 10%, now they're 30, 40%, 50% if they'll make the loan at all. And then on the other side, the bank is nailed with increasing their capital requirements 25% from 10%, I believe, to 12.5. So, you know, the banks are, you know, they're looking for the absolute best deal ever, you know, signed in gold. How do we make it work? So I'm willing to make the investments, but we've got to figure out how to pull those two parts together, because if we only look at government spending, that dollar stops the minute that construction project starts.
We've only got so much money.
Mr. President, if I could just make one quick point.
Gerard
Arpey, American Airlines. It wasn't that long ago you were a good customer of ours.
I was.
I understand you have a better ride today.
Yeah, it's not bad, I got to admit.
But you know,
I really miss taking off my shoes.
Before you get on the plane, right?
You and your family know firsthand that we operate with an antiquated air traffic control system. And I won't go through everything we went through earlier today, but to your earlier point, we don't have all the money that we need to spend. And I think looking to Secretary LaHood to try to make trade-offs about high-speed rail as a concept and those future dollars versus using that money today to create jobs, modernize the air traffic control system, save fuel, good for the planet. I think those kinds of trade-offs we can work with the Secretary on making and do good things sooner rather than later.
Good. Thank you, guys. Keep on working. Thanks, guys.
Yes, a lot of what we've been talking about here, not all of it, has to do with efficiency of the process, whether it's getting the people who normally are having a more tough time getting jobs or permitting issues or what have. The key here, the President mentioned it, is the money. The money, where's it going to come from to pay for all these things without driving the budget deficit through the roof? We have got to make sure that every dollar we spend on infrastructure has in front of it a process that's as efficient as possible at creating jobs, and creating all kinds of jobs, from the lowest levels of skills to the highest levels of skills. So everything we've talked about so far plays into that. But there's one other thing that we have to take a look at, and it has to do with when a bridge is being built or a transmission tower to move power from a windmill farm to the city or a solar farm to the city where the power is needed or to the industrial complex, all right, or the power plants that get built when they get built. You have to make sure that the materials going into those things are creating jobs here in America as well. And this is something that has become a near crisis right now, and I need to mention it to the group. Don't get it confused with Buy America, negativism, or what have you. Most of the transmission towers in this country today are made offshore, fabricated offshore, with steel produced offshore, sent here, and final assembled here, and then go up. Most of the power plants built in this country are built with not only with steel from offshore and transformers from offshore, but fabricated structure from offshore. All of the welders, all of the fitters, all of those fabrication jobs, they're not here. Fabricators in this country are working at a 30% to 40% of capacity rate. Steel mills in this country are working at a 65% rate, and that's up from 35% a year ago. And you can go on and on and on. The problem we're having is that foreign government money, I'm not going to mention any countries' names, I don't want to be accused of bashing any particular country, are coming in, and I sit on the board of Duke Energy, and I see exactly what's going on. They come in and they say, we will provide you with capital for a transmission line or a power plant. We will partner with you, but you have to use the materials made in our country, whether it be the wind turbines, like in the case of the Texas wind farm, or in the transmission towers, or in the structural for a coal-fired power plant, or a nuclear power plant, or a gas power plant. These things, the bridges. Look at the mess we've been in the Bay Bridge in Oakland. With the constant repair work and rework that had been done, that thing cost twice what it would have cost if they just had done it with material made here, fabricated here by U.S. workers. Now, this, if we don't get the multiplier effect from every dollar we spend on infrastructure so that it goes into all the other industries and businesses in this country that can employ people that aren't employing them today that have in the past, then we're not getting the most bang for our taxpayer dollar in these projects. And we're in a crisis today. The unemployment rate is not 10.2%. The underemployment rate is close to 20%, and we're going to see that again get worse tomorrow. We've got to put projects in place that create the maximum numbers of jobs in the short, medium, and long term to get out of this mess we're in. And we have to spend those dollars as efficiently as possible. So if we're not getting the full multiplier effect in this country, we're missing the boat. We're missing the boat terribly. And that's the biggest issue I wanted to put in front of the group today. The other thing I'd like to put in front of the group is we have to do things that attract private investment. This is not conventional infrastructure in a sense, but it's energy infrastructure. Every year we bring in foreign carbon units into this country in the way of oil and gas. It makes up half of our trade deficit. When oil goes back up to $150 a barrel, it's going to make up two-thirds of our trade deficit. Why can't we, as a government and the private side, work together in partnership like we did in World War II, like we did in the Apollo project, and increase the amount of domestic carbon units produced here? Now, this is not to downplay green energy. It's going to take us decades to get to a reduced carbon-based fuel economy. In the meantime, we're going to keep using foreign carbon units. Why not replace those foreign carbon units with domestic produced carbon units by increasing domestic production of oil and gas? The profits that come in from the revenues, the royalty fees, and everything else can be used to support infrastructure work that we need to get done in conventional infrastructure, create millions of jobs in this country over the next 5 to 10 years, which is what we need to do to deal with that kind of situation. It's not going to hurt the environment anymore, but what it's going to do is it's going to cut our trade deficit significantly, and it's going to create drought jobs here at home by doing that. And an energy infrastructure that comes about by increasing that domestic energy is going to be significant. We have to find things that people want invested in the private sector. And I guarantee you that's one thing that the private sector will invest in. Now, listen, this whole thing with offshore drilling and everything, we had oil spills from that contaminated the beaches in California, what have you. Most oil spills today come from tankers, not from drilling activities. We have the technology in place to prevent those accidents. We have the rules to have things done the right way. Let's enforce them, but let's get it done and create those jobs here at home. Drilling, transporting, welding, fabricating, you name it, and all the engineering jobs and the service jobs that go along with it. This is a big nut. Trade deficit is a big structural problem for us. And the lack of jobs is a big structural problem for us. This does it, and it does it with other people's money, not the taxpayers' money. We have to open our minds to that. As we transition to a lower carbon energy world, we have an opportunity here that we're ignoring. And I wanted to get that point across too. Thank you.
All right, thank you. I think we probably have about 5 more minutes, so we're gonna have to wrap up. I'd also point out, President was only going to be able to make it to two out of, I think, the 6 sessions, so we were lucky that we had him for, you were among the honored few. But if we have some final comments before we go back downstairs, that'd be terrific. Why don't we take these last 2 comments and then head back down?
Just very briefly, one thing that we failed to mention is with all this job creation, we have to make sure that the labor standards are high labor standards for these jobs. Because we're at the point, this is the moment have a chance to resurrect the middle class in the United States. And right now it's in deep trouble, and we're not going to be able to do it without good paying jobs, high road jobs, and we have to absolutely stay away from the low road approach to creating jobs. We need careers, not jobs.
Yeah.
Can I make a point on that? American Airlines maintains all of its airplanes in the United States by U.S. workers, members of the transport workers union. I have no gripe with airlines outsourcing their maintenance to China, El Salvador, wherever they want to do that. We have chosen not to do that. I do think, from a regulatory perspective, those airlines should face the same level of scrutiny in terms of the FAA looking at those maintenance facilities as we face here in the United States.
I think we had someone who actually hasn't commented yet. So
I have a couple numbers, and I guess my question to you is, did I hear in the beginning of this conversation, Mr. Secretary, you've gotten 4% of the money, but you've employed at least a quarter of the people in the whole project of the same?
Well, I mean, our figures show about 600,000 people this year. 75% of the money is out the door.
Which I think that...
And that doesn't account for high-speed rail, which is not... None of those have been... Or the Tiger Grants. Those are still pending.
And I think, and it can be proven that every dollar that we invest in the highways of the United States, it has a $5.40 return for things like reduced delays, improved safety, and lower vehicle operating costs. I represent the trucking industry, and if we could just do away with the bottlenecks and keep the trucks moving today, we can save $19 billion a year. A truck out here stopping traffic, stopped in a delay anywhere, is $1.50 a minute per truck. So the investment that we can put back in this to bring it back into play, we talk about investing in the right way. And one other comment, I have a biodiesel plant. And if the dollar tax credit doesn't get approved before the end of the year, we will close that plant down. We're one of 15% left in effect. 12 unemployed people, not a lot of people. But the biodiesel industry, which came around from green, and the government spent millions of dollars for it, in 2008, had 58,000 employees. Today, they've got 23,000 employees. And I guarantee you, January the 1st of 2010, if that thing isn't extended, there'll be zero people in that industry. Thank you, Peter, for waiting.
No problem. Why don't we have, I think there was someone over here. Last comment.
Yeah. Thank you. Look, there's so many things we could be for on the infrastructure. I'm trying to stay very short-term and focus on job creation, which is why I came here today, like all of you. And despite the comments made by gentleman to my right, Doug, who's up there now. The fact is that the American Recovery Act, I think, is proof that if you strategically invest in transportation infrastructure and you do it the right way, clearly the way that the DOT has attempted to roll it out, it can work. The operating assistance example raised by my neighbor here is a great example. In St. Louis, Missouri, there are 500 or so workers working today because of the support of the President and Secretary in using capital dollars to keep an operation going that was about to lay off a bunch of its workers and cut service. Those are perfect examples. Right now, you've got a high-speed rail program that we are so excited about, but you have another higher-speed railroad operating today in Amtrak. If you ever fully funded Amtrak beginning today, the CEO of that company would hire workers tomorrow to deliver services that the American people want. Lastly, let's not forget our ports and our maritime industry. I think if you look at the so-called shovel ready, I'm for efficiency, I'm for making them as efficient as possible, making sure we don't waste money. But the empirical data in this Recovery Act shows that it is the most efficient performing agency in the federal government in not only doling out the money, 80% obligation, but in putting people to work. So I'm hopeful that across all the modes, that the President's jobs plan going forward will bring transportation along and make it a transformation moment, where transportation is no longer sort of the stepchild of the government. It is actually an important public interest objective.
Very nice.